This is Focus West Michigan for Wednesday, October 22, 2025. I'm Joe Bilecki with your local news. Nonprofit Catherine's Health Center is expanding its healthcare options in Grand Rapids to treat both the unhoused and residents. WGVU's Dee Morrison explains how.
Catherine's Health Center primarily serves low-income patients at four clinics, including one at Mel Trotter Ministries, and now with a new mobile health unit, allowing staff to visit more places on a consistent schedule, meeting people experiencing homelessness where they are.
We practice relationship-based medicine, and so we try to give people a sense of where we'll be. We're essentially their medical home on wheels.
CEO Megan Erskine says the clinic at Mel Trotter Ministries is now open to the public, offering Hartside residents access to health care.
It's open 40 hours a week. We have medical services there, but we also have dental services there, behavioral health services, and case management services.
The clinic aims to be low barrier, low judgment, and low bias, offering walk-in access to primary care. Erskine says changes coming to Medicaid in the next 2 years will increase the burden on providers like Catherine's Health.
More uninsured individuals will use the emergency departments as hospitals as their regular care, and we're going to see more patients coming through our doors for primary care. We will be here to serve them. That is our mission. That is our purpose.
I'm Dee Morrison.
The Michigan Department of Transportation is proposing new rules that would ban long-term camping, panhandling, and waste disposal at rest areas and carpool lots. WGVU's David Limbaugh has more.
We've had kind of our unofficial MDOT rules for years that established kind of time frames and use for the facilities, but they were not ever statutorily based on anything.
MDOT's University Region Engineer Greg Losh says that would change under a proposed set of rules enforceable by law.
Establish a baseline level of expectations for the public so they know what to expect when they use our public facilities.
Some of those rules include no overnight camping, limiting vehicle parking to 48 hours or less, prohibiting the disposal of vehicle fluids and tires, and always keeping pets on a leash. Rules would pertain to all rest areas, carpool lots, roadside parks, and scenic overlooks maintained by MDOT. Losh says the rules are meant to enforce the intended use of these areas for short-term rests or emergencies, not to single out the unhoused who may use the facilities for longer stays.
These administrative rules are not written in a way that criminalizes homelessness or unhoused populations. These rules will apply to everybody.
If adopted, the rules would take effect 7 days after filing with the Secretary of State. I'm David Limbaugh.
A developer is asking Grand Haven for a property tax break to help him build an apartment building, but WGVU's Phil Dawson reports an opponent does not think the city should grant any big tax breaks when they're asking voters to approve a tax increase for public safety improvements.
I consider it a bailout.
Beechtree Leasing is asking Grand Haven City Council for a tax abatement worth nearly $640,000. To help them build a 45-unit apartment building on property they own at 1445 Columbus Avenue. And resident Mike Weavers is against it.
They're not poor. They're not building affordable homes.
During a public hearing on the request, Assistant City Manager Dano Colaware said the abatement freezes property taxes for 10 years, and without it, a consultant does not think the developer can go forward.
Their conclusion is that the project wouldn't be feasible.
There are currently two vacant commercial buildings on the property, and Weavers, who's also in the real estate business, says he thinks Beechtree Leasing sees market rate apartments as potentially more profitable.
All this is we can make more money this way than this way if we get this bailout.
City Council will vote on the request at a future meeting. Weavers was the only speaker at the public hearing, and he says a city asking residents to pay higher taxes for public safety can't afford tax breaks for market rate apartments.
They're asking the citizens who you are asking for a tax increase to subsidize this project.
I'm Phil Dawson.
Grand Valley State University is partnering with Michigan Central to expand workforce development and educational opportunities in Detroit. WGVU's Dee Morrison reports.
Michigan Central is a technology and cultural hub in Detroit, bringing together company leaders, investors, artists, educators, and others to network and collaborate. Now, Grand Valley State University is joining as a key partner, addressing critical skill gaps by training students and workers for in-demand jobs in mobility, advanced manufacturing, and robotics. Grand Valley will expand in Detroit, fostering regional talent development and economic growth, focusing on youth by introducing early pathways to higher education for middle and high schoolers. Michigan Central will connect GVSU students and faculty with new applied research opportunities through startups and other employers in the Detroit area. The partners will co-develop short-term credentialing and upskill programs for adults through GVSU's online and hybrid degree programs. Youth programming will launch in early 2026. I'm Dee Morrison.
Coming up soon, another one of StoryCorps' One Small Step conversations, but first, news from around the state. A bill to increase transparency in the Michigan budget process passed out of the state Senate on Tuesday, but as Colin Jackson reports, lawmakers across the aisle want to see more.
The bill would require lawmakers to publicly name spending items they're requesting in the state budget at least 10 days ahead of a vote. Republican Senator Jonathan Lindsay says the bill doesn't go far enough.
I don't believe that this law is actually tight enough to accomplish what it says it's going to, but more importantly, on a structural level, I think it's going to fail down the road.
Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Jeremy Moss says the bill is important, but he implores Republican state House leadership to take up Senate-passed bills to apply open records laws to lawmakers and the governor.
We passed these here the very first day of voting in this chamber, and there they have sat in the House ever since.
The earmark bill now goes to the House. I'm Colin Jackson.
An animal rights group plans to appeal a case to the Michigan Supreme Court seeking an unlawful imprisonment hearing for six chimpanzees at an Upper Peninsula zoo. We have more from Rick Pluta.
The Non-Human Rights Project argues that chimpanzees are genetically close to humans, have human-like needs, and are entitled to some rights typically guaranteed to humans. Attorney Jake Davis says he hopes for a groundbreaking decision in Michigan that chimpanzees have common law habeas corpus rights.
You can be the first. Every case was novel at a certain point.
The group wants the chimpanzees moved from a zoo to a nature preserve that is closer to their wildlife habitat. The Michigan Court of Appeals ruled last week that the chimpanzees do not have legal status that allows the Non-Human Rights Project to sue on their behalf. The DeYoung Family Zoo in Menominee County did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Rick Pluta.
Focus West Michigan is brought to you by listeners like you. To support this show and everything we do here, visit wgvunews.org and click the donate button. And for a weekly dose of news right to your inbox, sign up for the WGVU newsletter. Today, in our One Small Step conversation, we bring together two strangers for a conversation about their lives, not politics. Daniel and Gloria both grew up in the Los Angeles area. They question their religious upbringing's belief and convictions, discovering caring for others is core to who they've become.
Hi, Gloria. My name is Daniel. I am 73 years old, not very far from 74. I'm from Grand Rapids.
Hi, Daniel. My name is Gloria. I am 71 years old, not too far from 72, so we're really close in age. I am from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was born and grew up in Los Angeles, California. Everyone around me spoke Spanish, basically. I didn't speak English until I started school. I'm the oldest of four children, and the reason is someone told my dad that if he wanted me to do well in school, to start speaking English at home. So then we switched completely to English. The funny thing about growing up in Los Angeles, I was close to a river. I thought all rivers had concrete banks.
Yeah. And we're mostly dry most of the year.
Exactly. And so the first time I actually saw a real river, I was on a bus going up north to Sacramento, which was about 8 or 9 hour drive. It's like, wow, there's no concrete. So Daniel, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in the Los Angeles area too. I grew up in Hawthorne, which is midway between LA and Long Beach.
Right.
And I didn't have the same reaction to the concrete LA River that you did, but I had a different, somewhat similar experience. I remember reading the little Dick and Jane and Spock books. Maybe you saw those too in, I don't know, first or second grade. That's how you learned to read in those days. And I remember seeing them playing in the colorful leaves. And I thought, that must be what happened in the olden days, because of course that never happens now. Well, now I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I see all the colorful leaves. And I realize that actually it's not a chronological issue. It's a geographical one. It was a very family-oriented suburb when I was growing up. We had a pretty easy life. Summertime, my parents would let me leave the house almost as soon as breakfast was done and didn't really expect me back until dinner time. So I ranged on my bike with my buddies pretty widely up and down Hawthorne Boulevard and Rosecrans. Mm-hmm.
I lived basically in Pico Rivera. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a girls' Catholic high school because I wanted to, you know. Yeah. And so my mom started working when I went to high school because, you know, to afford the tuition, even though I got a partial scholarship. Mm-hmm. So that was during the 60s. And that's when I started asking a lot of questions about, well, why can't women or girls be altar boys? I wanted to be an altar boy. My mom's family came from Mexico. Mm-hmm. They came in the 1920s, and they were actually fleeing a war called the Cristero War. Catholics were being persecuted and killed. There was priests, etc. They were being killed.
Interesting. Yeah, I grew up a very fundamentalist Baptist church. In fact, they were called the Conservative Baptist Church. That wasn't an adjective. That was actually the name. Maybe a bit like you, as I got older, particularly as I got into college and began being confronted with different points of view and realized, okay, I have not been told the whole story. I began a process of disentangling myself, you might say, from some of the very rigid and frankly unhelpful convictions and ideas that, you know, I'd grown up with.
Where did you go to college?
Westmont in Santa Barbara. It's a small Christian liberal arts college. And I was pretty influential, as a matter of fact. That's where I first began to realize, okay, it's a Christian college, but it was not a fundamentalist institution. And so I began encountering ideas that really definitely broadened my understanding of what it meant to be a Christian. And particularly a one political science professor named Ed Laux, who loved to tweak his mostly very conservative students with quotes from the minor prophets in the Old Testament and other passages from the Bible that made it real clear God really cares about poor people, immigrants, about women, and especially widows and other people that are kind of on the margins, and that it's the measure of a society, how well it treats those at the bottom, not how well it enriches those at the top. And, you know, that was really a very important inflection point in my own sort of intellectual growing up. That's hard work, isn't it? Going to college while you're working full time.
It took me 10 years. And this was in Southern California, so I'd be, you know, working full time. And I remember driving those lovely freeways, drive a few feet and look down at my accounting book and then drive a little bit more. And people say, well, why are you doing this? I go, well, I was an accounting clerk. I said, you know, I know I can do better.
So what career did that lead to?
Once I graduated, I had been working for someone who I was telling him about my last capstone business class, business cases. And he said, you need to get your MBA. I go, seriously? I had to go to school at night for 10 years. And now I need to get my MBA? Uh-huh. And he said, think about it. So I thought about it. I said, you know, it doesn't hurt to apply. So I applied to Cal State Fullerton, as well as Stanford and Harvard Business School, because I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to quit my job and go to school full time for my MBA, I did a cost benefit analysis. Where would it be worth it? Well, it's either going to school at night again at Cal State Fullerton or quitting and going to Harvard or Stanford, where, you know, it would be well worth it. So I got accepted to Harvard.
Wow, good for you. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. And then I ended up coming to Detroit to work for Chrysler in their finance area. So that's how I got to Michigan.
How do you define patriotism?
Patriotism is loving your country, but also acknowledging its faults and working hard to make certain that everyone is able to be a part of it and to share in the benefits of living in the United States. Regardless of what's going on, I went to a rally last night. You know, they started off with the Pledge of Allegiance, which gave me tears because it's been a long time since I've said it. Mm-hmm. And we have a promise here. Mm-hmm. It isn't always actuated. You know, you and I went through the 60s, so we know how strange things can get.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully they come back to where we're able to care for each other and care for people that we don't even know just by our elected officials who should be worthy of respect.
Amen.
How about you? You keep saying amen.
Well, I agree with you just absolutely entirely. I'm a historian, and so I'm afraid I'm very familiar with the darker side of American history. When I taught students, my aim was not to produce cynics, nor naive, rose-tinted glasses kind of people, but people that recognize here's a human institution with flaws, but it's also been productive of a lot of good. So you want to put your shoulder to the wheel to encourage what's healthy and good. And where necessary, you need to stand up against that, which is not healthy, not helpful. One little anecdote that illustrates maybe another aspect of this. I was in Nicaragua many years ago during the 1980s, actually. You know what was going on in Central America then. I was with a student group and we were interviewing people from all sort of walks of life. And there was a real civil war going on there. And we interviewed a doctor who was treating people in a pretty shabby clinic. And somebody asked him, would you be better off if you went to the United States? Because this is a pretty difficult place to live. And his response was, I suppose I'd be better off myself. But who would care for these people if I were gone? To me, that is the most noble kind of patriotism. You love your country, you love the people in your country, and you're willing to put aside your own most immediate personal interest for the good of the larger collective. And it's not the kind of nationalism that says we hate other kinds of people in our country or we hate other people in other countries. It's more, I really care about this community. I was born here and I've decided that that means it's my responsibility to contribute my gifts to this community. That stuck in my head as the best kind of patriotism. Can you tell me about someone who has been the kindest to you in your life?
Sure. I remember when we were buying our first house years ago, the banker woman, she was very helpful in leading us through the process. And then when we went to buy our second house after that, she was very helpful and just sort of encouraged us to really dream. Because I'm Latina, my husband's Black, and I would always go and find the house. You know, that was always in the back of my mind.
My heart breaks.
And you, Daniel?
Well, we've received many kindnesses, but I guess the one that pops first into my mind is kind of a very sad one. The morning I found my older son had taken his own life in our own house, we called our pastor and the news sort of leaked out real fast. And a couple that we've known for a number of years in Grand Rapids showed up very early in the day and they played traffic cop. They brought food. They let people into our house. My wife and I, of course, were absolutely in shock. That whole day, all we had to do was stand there and thank people for showing their kindness. And this couple stayed there the whole day. I've never forgotten that. It was the worst day of my life.
What will you take with you from this experience?
It seems to me we have a lot of similarities in terms of our life trajectories. Talking to you, I sense, okay, we've shared a lot of the same kinds of experiences and come to some of the same kinds of conclusions generally, even if in particular cases we might have our differences. So maybe that's what I'll take away from this interview.
You know, we started off growing up in the same general area.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah, with the same general influences, Vietnam War being really big during our formative years. I sense that we've ended up in similar places.
This has been Focus West Michigan from WGVU for Wednesday, October 22, 2025. I'm Joe Bilecki. Our audio operations manager is Rick Bierling, and our news and public affairs director is Patrick Center. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll be back with more news and events in West Michigan tomorrow. Thanks for listening.